This is Caught in the Act with Tim Clark.
Welcome back. Before we get into this week's episode, a warning to our Indigenous and Torres Strait Islander listeners. This episode contains the name of an Indigenous person who has died. This episode also contains content about suicide and self-harm and may be distressing. If you or anyone you know needs support, contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. Just after 2 a.m., on October the 12th, 2023, an ambulance raced to WA's main maximum security prison at Casuarina. A 16-year-old boy had self-harmed inside his cell at the notorious Unit 18, the juvenile facility located within the grounds of the adult prison. That teen was rushed to hospital, where he was put on life support. 1 week later, surrounded by family, he took his final breath. After his death was grief from his family, from his friends, and from the community. But there was also outrage. How could this happen in Western Australia, in a prison that was supposed to look after those inside it? Calls for change became deafening shouts. An inquiry was held, and the revelations uncovered shocked the state. That boy's name was Cleveland Dodd. And joining me today on Caught in the Act is my colleague, Rebecca LeMay, who will help us walk through the coronial inquest into Cleveland's death, which began earlier this week. Rebecca, thanks for joining us on Caught in the Act this week, mate.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
So, we'll start with youth justice. Youth justice is always a hot topic, a fiery topic, a hot button topic for the community because on both sides, obviously, no one wants to be the victim of crime. And when the alleged criminal is under 18, under 16, sometimes under 14, it enrages and it inflames passions. The old premier in this state, Mark McGowan, towards the end of his tenure in the top job in WA politics, was very strong on youth justice. And not, I have to say, in a typically Labour way.
Totally, utterly unacceptable. It's a form of terrorism they're engaged in.
He called them the most disruptive young prisoners in the state. And it was in the background, or on the back of that type of rhetoric, that the McGowan government decided to move the most disruptive cohort to Casuarina Prison, the maximum security prison in Perth and in Western Australia. Unit 18, it was called back, and even on the day, even as I was listening to that press conference, my eyes widened, my eyebrows raised, because that was something to do for this government.
It certainly was. And as the coroner, Phil Urquhart, has pointed out in his opening on Wednesday, he emphasised multiple times that this is a facility that's not purpose-built for juveniles, and that's going to be a central focus throughout the inquest. Begs the question, should there be? I imagine so.
But that was pointed out within hours by human rights advocates, by youth justice experts, that putting young, vulnerable, alleged, most of them criminals, into an adult, high security, maximum security prison setting, it jarred. It just jarred everyone. Is this what it's come to? Is this the only option for these kids?
Absolutely. And you know, questions have been raised and it's been pointed out that these sorts of things are in breach of international human rights obligations. So, you know, WA really does seem to be lagging behind other parts of the country. We're often likened to Queensland. We know that they've got a pretty tough policy on youth justice there. So in justifying the opening of Unit 18, the state government cited some pretty major damage. I think it ended up being calculated as about $22 million worth of damage that was done in a major riot at the facility at Banksia Hill earlier that year. And what they said was, we need a hardened facility. We need something that where the walls are more strengthened, because basically whenever there was damage done to a cell at Banksia Hill, repair efforts were made and it'd be damaged again.
And the deplorable conditions at the only youth justice facility in Western Australia, Banksia Hill, they were not only causing issues for the kids inside, but they were also causing issues for the government outside, because there had been various, well, judgments in WA Supreme Court saying that the conditions that the kids were being held in, left over and, you know, a layover from COVID about lockdowns and all that, were not only harmful, but they were illegal. They were actually against the Children's Court Act or the act that governs how young offenders should be treated. So the government, that, you know, people behind the scenes told me the government was between a rock and a hard place. You know, the WA Supreme Court were telling them you can't keep them like this anymore, but they didn't have anywhere else to put them. So they came up with this solution, which with hindsight we now know was disastrous.
Absolutely. The lockdowns at UNA18 were absolutely horrendous. And on Cleveland's final day there, he indeed only had a little over 1 hour out. And that wasn't unusual. These were the sorts of things that were coming out, particularly in very scathing commentary from Children's Court President Hilton Quayle. Mm. He used multiple sentencings of other young detainees to point out that this was continuing, that it was in flagrant impunity in the face of those two Supreme Court rulings by Justice Tottle. And in one of the more recent ones, he described it as a barbaric dungeon.
Mm. 22 hours a day locked up in a cell. And that's the average. That was the average for Unit 18 detainees. That was done as punishment. That was done as protection, supposedly. And it was also done because of staff shortages. The youth custodial officers were like any other prison officer. They could only take so much, and a lot of them were on sick leave and long-term illness leave, and it took its toll on the on them, on the system, and ultimately on the children that were there. December 2023, in one of those judgments, at least 20 young people under the age of 18 had self-harmed or tried to take their own lives in Unit 18 since moving from Banksia the previous year, which is an astonishing figure to even say, let alone contemplate.
Absolutely. And what was absolutely starkly shocking, hearing just the opening addresses the other day, how many other detainees had threatened or actually engaged in self-harm that very same day that Cleveland threatened eight times that he would harm himself.
Yeah. So, Cleveland, you mentioned his name there. Give us a little bit of background about him and his upbringing, his family, and how he found himself in a youth detention facility.
Well, Cleveland was described by the counsel assisting Anthony Crocker as having a troubled upbringing. That's not without contention by his family. They would say that they had their problems, like many other, almost every other family, and that the portrayal of him as being deeply troubled wasn't quite right. They say he was actually quite a bright and communicative kid. Mm-hmm. Certainly a video clip that was played at the beginning showing a smiling, outgoing child, introducing other young children as they took part in outback wood gathering for elders. Mm. He certainly seemed like he was bubbly in his early years. Unfortunately, though, he did come into trouble, and he was pinging back and forth between his father's family in Meekatharra, mm-hmm. And the Laverton Kalgoorlie area where his mum lived. So, his encounter with the justice system was pretty early on, and he was in and out of trouble.
We'll point out here, obviously, in Court of the Act, we try and go into detail about cases and why they appear in court and in a judicial setting. But in terms of Children's Court, this is a tricky one, because the law in Western Australia says that we usually aren't allowed to identify any child that is involved in the youth justice system to protect them going forward into their lives. This is obviously not the case for Cleveland, because he was identified quite quickly after he took his own life. But what we are not allowed to do by law is go into too much detail about why he was in the justice system. All we can really say, Beck, is that he was there. He had been there for a while, and it hadn't been easy for him or the family. I think that's as far and as fair as we can go.
Indeed, yeah.
So, as we've said, October the 12th, 2023, Cleveland was in Unit 18 and he was in distress. Beck, we learned, as I say, for the first time this week, just how much distress he was in on that day. Why don't you take us through what the council assisting has opened this coronial inquest? What facts are we working on?
Well, that day, Cleveland was very much like all the other detainees, just very much looking forward to and focused on time when they would get up, as they called it, or get out of their cell. And as we've already discussed, that was a pretty brief and rare thing on a daily basis. Cleveland took the view, and he did remark, that he felt like he was always last. And it comes back to those staffing shortages, mm-hmm. or it seems to be coming back to those staffing shortages, that there was a rotational approach where the kids come out, you know, maybe one or two at a time. But it's all sort of bound by how available the officers are to actually, you know, facilitate that. Mm-hmm. He was quite frustrated by the fact that it was about 4:40 in the afternoon by the time he was actually allowed out. And he attempted to call family. Doesn't sound like he could get in touch with them. But there were other frustrations during the night. A detainee in the cell next to him was banging around. He repeatedly called to youth custodial officers and said, make him stop. And another unusual thing was that there was a scheduled or a planned outage of the power. So the televisions and the you had only essential lights, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But things that, like the televisions in their cells, were turned off, and that happened around 11:30 p.m. Thing was, the radio had been turned off, and that meant that the authorities within Unit 18 weren't aware of the fact that the planned outage had happened. So when Cleveland said, why has my television been turned off? Mm. He was told, I don't know. And he remarked that he had felt ignored.
Mm. So ignored, in fact, that, as you mentioned previously, he then began openly telling guards that he intended to self-harm. He said clearly and strikingly, yes, I'm done. I'm through. I want to end my life. What was the reaction, as we know, or as we so far know, from the guards to those claims that he made?
Well, that's certainly going to be teased out in more detail, but from what I can tell from the opening address by Council Assisting, is that it was really only towards the end there where, you know, there were expressions like, you know, oh, don't talk like that, mate, you know. One of the occasions he had said it in reaction to the fact that he wanted some water brought to his cell. The fact that water had to be brought to his cell is in itself remarkable. The taps in his room had been damaged, in his cell had been damaged, and so he was relying on the guards to bring it to him. On the final occasion he asked for water, he was told, no, you had four cups with dinner, and he was refused. It wasn't brought to him. So it really wasn't towards the end there until they started to say, okay, you know, let's send one of the guards that you can relate to more, you know, that he'd asked for to come and have a chat with you. But unfortunately, it was too late.
Mm. That guard got there. Realised something was horribly wrong, but the gap between Cleveland calling for help and that guard arriving, 16 minutes, we understand, or an initial report that was initial internal report that was done and released by the government, 16 minutes. That's a long time. That's a hell of a long time. In fact, that's enough time, as we now know, for a young person to self-harm to such an extent that they are a week later unable to be revived.
Absolutely. Mm. And what emerged in the opening address was that 10 of those minutes were spent by this youth custodial officer that Cleveland had asked for, dealing with another detainee in the same wing, again, who had threatened or enacted actual self-harm. Mm. So he had an obligation. In fact, this child was at the highest level of the ARM system, the at-risk management system, mm-hmm. and as counsel assisting, noted he did have an obligation to go and check on that kid. Mm. Cleveland was not on the same rating at that time.
Yeah. And there's also the issue about the radios inside that Unit 18. You would think an essential, prerequisite for any guard or officer in a position of authority and of care. But it has emerged since and will emerge more so in the inquest as it goes along that those radios, what's the recent term, suboptimal, shall we say?
Yeah, and not being carried by the guards as they did their patrols around, including that very officer who went to go and respond to Cleveland's final warnings that he was about to harm himself. It's just beggars belief, really, completely against department policy. And it meant that, of course, he couldn't alert his colleagues as soon as possible to what he saw, that horrific scene that he saw when he peered through the window of his door.
Mm. And the finding that emerged pre-inquest, which caused me most concern or shock or... disdain, I suppose, is that an allegation that one of those guards in Unit 18 was either resting or asleep at the time that this emergency was unfolding.
It certainly seems that way. So the officer who I just mentioned who discovered the scene, he was described as responding in a hurried manner to go and tell a senior officer who was in a darkened room. The officer alerting him had to turn the light on, and he was described as coming up from a reclining position, seen in CCTV footage, putting his boots on and buttoning up his shirt. So certainly appears as if he wasn't on sort of high alert for this sort of situation. And that would obviously have added to the delay. Another confounding thing was that both of them walked past the nurse's station to run back to Cleveland's cell. Why on earth they would not have alerted her on the way is something that will be explored. Her office was also darkened.
As we've mentioned, there were several inquiries launched immediately on Cleveland's death. He was the first child to die in youth custody in more than a decade. John Pat was the last one, which, a sidebar, to that is that the current AG in this state, John Quigley, was the lawyer who defended some of the police officers who were involved in that death in custody. And Cleveland was the first young offender or a young remand prisoner to ever die in a WA prison. So this was an unprecedented set of circumstances, but unfortunately, from those who have been watching the youth justice system closely and from afar in the last 10 years, not actually quite surprising. Those internal reviews were done and the results were released, or some of them. The police minister, Minister Papalia, in his summing up of one of those reports, said,
"Individually, none of these things are acceptable. Collectively, they are disturbing and confirm the need for significant cultural change."
The Department of Justice probe found that some welfare checks that were claimed to have been done on Cleveland on the night that he died may have been fabricated. The broken vent on which he actually hung himself had gone unrepaired for nearly a month. The senior officer obviously sleeping in the office that we've just talked about, and the lack of radios, We also learned this week, Beck, that the coroner's office was involved almost immediately, which is unprecedented, according to Phil Urquhart. And I have no doubt that Mr. Urquhart, a very experienced lawyer turned coroner, would know the history of the involvement in coroner's offices in many deaths. And if he says this has never happened before, it hasn't.
Absolutely. They were there within hours. He was there himself with both of his counsel assisting. They were examining the cell, watching the collection of evidence, the taking of photographs. This literally was the same day, really. They say the next day, but given that this all unfolded in the early hours of the 12th of October, that was quite a rapid response. The other unprecedented aspect to this coronial investigation is the fact that it was filed for early listing before the brief was compiled, before all the evidence. And that's still coming in. That's ongoing. So obviously there's a heck of a lot of material to go through. And obviously with the fact that it's a two-pronged inquest resuming on July 22 after going through next week, that will give some more time for all of that stuff to pour in. But I have no doubt that it will continue between now and then.
Yeah. And that is... Well, that says two things to me, that obviously the government were super aware that this, even from the moment that emergency call was probably made to a minister's chief of staff or possibly the minister himself, they knew this was going to be damaging to the government. And that's a horrible thing to say when a young person has lost his life, but it's a harsh reality that youth justice, as I mentioned off the top, is a hot button topic. It's a political topic, and when a young man takes his own life in an adult prison that you put him there, that's going to come back to the government that made that decision. So, getting a coroner's office involved is a smart move, because the coroner's office are independent. They have extraordinary powers, actually, under the Coroner's Act in this state. And also, they are allowed to ask questions and compel people to answer questions that pretty much no other law officer in the state can. So that's interesting in itself. And then the expedition of the inquest. I've spoken on this podcast before about the backlog, particularly in the WA Coroner's Office. Inquests can take up to 3 to 4 years to go from even being placed in the Coroner's Office to a potential public hearing. There are a finite amount of staff and coroners to deal with the enormous amount of reportable deaths. But the fact that Cleveland's case was put immediately to the top of the pile, a senior coroner was sent to the scene within 24 hours of it happening, along with staff, and the fact that, as I said, October last year, and here we are in April this year, that the inquest is on and happening, even with more evidence to come in, is, well, it's a testimony to the wheels of justice can move quickly when the pressure is on for them too.
Absolutely, and rightly so, because if you think about the implications of this, it has implications for every single juvenile in detention. We know that the circumstances, the care, or the quality of the care and the supervision that he had is absolutely central to this inquest. So it's a matter of utter urgency that we find out what level of care or supervision was at. Hopefully how much it's improved. I'd like to think it has, because it has ramifications for the safety of every other child in detention in the state.
Yeah. Now, there's been some changes on the back of Cleveland's death already, even before the coroner has made what I'm sure will be fulsome and wide-ranging recommendations after he's completed his inquest. And walk us through some of the things that have happened since Cleveland's death, but before the inquest has opened, Beck.
So the fallout was rapid, beyond just, as you say, the speed of the inquest being convened. The waves, the choppy waves, were certainly felt through the highest ranks of corrective services pretty well immediately in the wake of this tragedy. Within about a fortnight, we had the Commissioner for Corrective Services, Mike Reynolds, shown the door. And then in December, we had the Department of Justice Director General, Adam Thomason, resign. So one would think that this would have had, you know, some sort of influence on his decision, given that it was an entirely foreseeable tragedy that, you know, advocates for justice reform had been warning about for months.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like you say, it was no surprise.
Yeah. November 2023, we had the government announcing that Unit 18 would be replaced with a high security but therapeutic detention centre to be housed alongside Banksia Hill. This is what the Premier Roger Cook said about that potential facility.
Our new purpose-built detention centre is to be constructed to house our state's most challenging juvenile detainees. This will ultimately mean Unit 18 will eventually close in a safe and sensible manner, which is what I've long been saying I want to see happen. The new facility will be specifically designed to meet high security and therapeutic needs of detainees who are complex, challenging and often dangerous.
And the mid-year budget review pledged a whopping $77.1 million for youth justice in a state that is regularly posting billions of dollars in surplus. Beck, so that brings us to this week. The family of Cleveland Dodd have obviously been waiting months and months for this day and week to come. And they were very vocal about what they hoped would come from it, so much so that they marched from one spot in the city to the door of the Department of Justice in Perth to basically let people know we're here, we're listening, and we're not going away.
Absolutely. More than 50 relatives have travelled from the regions to come and watch this. Not all of them have been able to be accommodated within the coroner's court. Media sequestered away in a separate room, which is good. Gives them opportunity to get more family in there. And the mother, Nadine Dodd, has been so far reluctant to speak to the media. She's obviously still very distressed by what she's hearing, and I'm sure that's going to continue as the inquest goes on. But we have spoken to the one of Cleveland's grandmothers, Glenda Mippy, on the paternal side, and his auntie, Bonnie Gentle. And when they came out after hearing the opening addresses and seeing those clips of guards walking around and the concourses outside the cells just immediately before and immediately after that horrific discovery, what absolutely struck them was the 8 times that Cleveland had made those threats. In the interim findings from the Internal Department of Justice investigation, they'd said that there were 2 calls on the cell intercom. So 8 was quite a shock for them. And the aspect of the poor boy having to ask for water and having that knocked back, that also was completely shocking to them. So the expression they used was, you'd give an animal water.
And you mentioned there CCTV, obviously inside prison CCTV, any prison, youth or adult, CCTV is vital for keeping an eye on people, security, being aware of the surroundings. The CCTV around this case is going to be important, but it's not a moment by moment depiction of what went on in Cleveland's cell, because part of it, a long time of that day, the CCTV was actually obscured by Cleveland himself.
11 hours, all but 23 seconds of 11 hours. And that paper didn't come down until the guards were in his room performing resuscitation.
So this is wet toilet paper that Cleveland has placed on the camera, and no one has noticed that it's been up there for almost half the day.
I imagine it probably was noticed, but it's just such a common occurrence. It's most of the detainees do that. They want that for a little bit of privacy. They, they have their latrine in there. Maybe they just don't like feeling like they're in a fishbowl all the time. And perhaps the officers get to a point where they're going in and taking it down so often that they just don't bother. But tragically, in Cleveland's case, the 23 seconds that it was actually not on his CCTV camera that day was when it plopped down of its own accord. Mm. And he promptly, as we see, within 23 seconds, he's gone and put it back up again.
Mm. And that CCTV was shown in court this week twice. Once first to the lawyers, all the lawyers that are involved in the case that are advocating for the various agencies and for Cleveland's family. And then Cleveland's family themselves, or a select group of them, were allowed in court to watch that CCTV for themselves. But they were closed court sessions. Did Phil Urquhart give an explanation to that, or was it self-explanatory to him that this is very distressing footage and shouldn't be viewed by the wider public for various reasons?
The latter, yeah. He certainly he didn't give any explanation. And I think it's because of the fact that it was clearly distressing. Mm. When they did show the little clips of the guards walking around outside the cells, it was expressed multiple times, you will not be seeing Cleveland. So they were obviously bracing them for the fact that, you know, they didn't have to worry about that day. Mm. But I imagine the next day there probably would have been things that were more confronting for them.
Mm. And so give us the outline of the outline. So you heard from all the reporters in court, or everyone in court heard from Phil Urquhart first, who's the coroner who'll be overseeing the inquest. And then you heard from the counsel assisting. For those who don't know, the counsel assisting is an appointed lawyer that is basically leads the evidence and directs and helps the coroner along the way, including asking a lot of the questions, or gets first dibs at asking the questions of all the witnesses, but is also behind the scenes responsible for pulling the brief together and organizing the witnesses and making sure they know what's coming and the order and all that type of thing. So tell us what those two individuals had to say on the first morning of the inquest, Beck.
They both went out of their way to emphasise, and it's never a bad idea to do this, to not assume that people have ever seen an inquest before or understand how it runs and what its purpose is. But both of them emphasised that it was not an exercise in apportioning blame to an individual or an institution. It was about finding out where areas could be improved and trying to avert a similar tragedy in the future. That might have been tough to hear. That there wouldn't be any apportioning of blame, but it was something that they both stressed.
Mm. And it's key to point out, that's not part of the coroner's job, never is. A coroner in inquest is a fact-finding mission. It's to find out, the ultimate role of a coroner in inquest is to find out how a person died and then rule on that reason. And so that's any inquest, not just this one. But in inquests such as this, emotional ones, ones where, you know, potential foul play has been involved, you sort of think, oh, well, you know, who's to blame here? And a coroner by law is actually not allowed to apportion blame, but he can make adverse findings against organisations and people if he wishes to. And those people and organisations are given fair warning at the end of an inquest. An adverse finding is coming, and you might want to get your ducks in a row to answer those adverse findings. And that'll be interesting to see whether Mr. Urquhart makes any adverse findings against individuals or organisations, or dare we say it, ministerial think tanks. I'm not sure how far or how high he can go, but as I've said before, coroners have pretty wide-ranging powers in WA.
Mm.
And then counsel assisting walked through the evidence that we're likely to hear. Give us some of that preview and what we are likely to hear today, next week, and in the second tranche of hearings later in the year.
So first up, we have the youth custodial officer who discovered Cleveland and was the one who was described as hurriedly responding but not carrying his radio. Next week, we have two more youth custodial officers. I must point out that over the next couple of days, over the next 5 days, each witness has a full day of testimony. So it's going to be quite an intense grilling for them. Mid next week, then, we get the nurse who was on duty that night. And after that, the unit manager. And a full day has actually been kept free on the Friday for any overruns. Mm. So they're more than certainly expecting each individual to get a full day's questioning.
Yeah. And you, I mean, it's always quite an intense atmosphere in a coroner's court because, obviously, inevitably, someone has died. And so, yeah, I'm sure those who were with Cleveland in the days and weeks and months leading up to his death will feel terribly about it. But they are going to have to answer some hard questions as well, particularly, I would imagine, from the very experienced barrister who's been assigned to represent Cleveland's family.
Indeed. And in fact, it's even been flagged that other detainees who were there at the time may be giving statements that will come through counsel appearing. And then, of course, when it reconvenes in July and then running through to August, instead of eyewitnesses, we're going to move on to the officials. So the highest ranks of the department. We'll even be hearing from the Department of Communities. Obviously, there's that claim that there was some involvement in Cleveland's life. So we're going to be hearing about policies and procedures. And as dry as that sounds compared to the actual evidence of what happened on the night, that really goes to the heart of what this is about, and that's working out where the failings were. Should there be procedures that are improved for how to respond when a child threatens self-harm? Are the responses so far inadequate? We need to find out what those policies and procedures are.
And hopefully some structural, maybe we might finally get to hear how youth justice can adequately keep young offenders in this state secure, but also safe. As I mentioned off the, previously, the government has promised a new facility, but prisons don't just pop up overnight. So how long is that going to take? How much is it going to cost? Who's going to plan it? Who's going to run it? Hopefully we might find a little bit about that as well, because ultimately, I mean, that's the history we know of youth justice in this state. It hasn't adequately been planned, because if it had done, then they wouldn't have needed to open a wing in an adult maximum security prison to place the angriest and most disturbed cohort of young offenders in this state in there.
Absolutely. And we still don't have an opening date for that new facility. It's still in the planning stages. And by July, when we get to the second part of this inquest, it will have been 2 years that Unit 18, which was meant to be a temporary facility, will have been opened. So much for short term.
Beck, thanks so much for sparing some time. You've got to rush off and actually get to the first day of proper evidence in this inquest, so I will let you go. But thanks, mate, and we will keep in touch, I'm sure, as the inquest rolls on.
Thanks, Clarkie.
And once again, as always, thanks very much to the loyal Court in the Act listenership for joining us this week. I will be taking a short break for the next couple of weeks, so will the podcast. But please, don't unsubscribe. We'll be back rearing and fresh and full of stories ready to go for the rest of the year. So you can obviously get this podcast from wherever you usually get your podcasts. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in court, don't get caught short. Get caught in the act instead. See you in a couple of weeks.